Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. It's our morning version, sponsored by nobody. Sorry, Mika Brzezinski. No morning Joe here. It's John and JJ instead. Me with my coffee, JJ with the bapper, and we're going to talk prospects to pennants. That's the much-awaited cover feature of our minor league preview issue, where we obviously discuss that the Kansas City Royals have the #1 farm system in the minor league and you know, all major league organizations. But JJ, the point of the prospects to pennants feature is, what do you do with these prospects? How do you turn prospects into a winning organization? And I think it's a fascinating topic. I love that we kind of go next level a little bit with this, you know, as we did with Aaron Fitt when he, okay, the bats are changing. What is that going to do to college baseball? Well, defense is at a premium. Here we're talking about the prospects and, you know, how the Royals can make a winning team out of this. And one of the ways you decided to attack this issue is, okay, let's look back at other farm systems that have been plentiful with prospects. What was their track record? And kind of what we found, JJ, was that going from great prospects to pennants is a lot harder than it looks.
It's not something where you just build a great farm system and then you just wait 3 years and then you roll in you celebrate your World Series titles, which kind of, I think, makes a whole lot of sense if you think about it, because if it was that easy, then I know building a farm system's hard, but if it was that easy, then everyone would be doing it.
Right.
And there are a lot of definitely a lot of pieces involved in taking a really good farm system and turning it into a successful big league club. And there are a lot of kind of hurdles along that way too, especially when you talk about service time and free agency and all that. The window often is can be pretty small.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about I think one of the more, you need to be having coffee like, yeah, I am, or at least some hot tea. One of the most instructive examples is also the most recent examples, because all our listeners, young and old, will remember this, and I think remember a lot of the details. And that's the Cleveland Indians. You know, the Indians really have done this twice. You discussed in the handbook era their group of prospects, basically the Bartolo Colon windfall era of prospects.
Right.
If you think about it, the Indians really did it twice, because they did it in
the
early 90s.
The Carlos Baerga group.
Yeah, I like to think of it as the Eddie Taubensy windfall. you know, they trade Eddie Taubensy to the Astros. They get Kenny Lofton. And Kenny Lofton seemed to be the final piece. But in those early, you know, the mid-90s, when the Indians first took off and when Cleveland first rocked, you know, they had some homegrown pieces. And they had, you know, it was actually kind of a similar formula back then as right now. The problem with the Indians organization was developing pitching. And in that first good Indians wave, you know, all their pitchers were out of the organization. The only homegrown guys they really developed were Chuck Nagy and then, of course, Jarrett Wright, who was almost a World Series hero in 1997. But because they didn't have anyone else, they rushed Jarrett Wright into the breach, and, you know, he didn't really handle success well after the 97 season. Really only had a couple more decent years, and his best year probably came in Atlanta. But that first wave, all kinds of offensive talent, you know, Joey Bell, don't call me Joey Bell, Albert Bell, you know, Kenny Lofton, Baerga, Sandy Alomar Jr., when they got in their trade, you know, they had trades, they had homegrown guys. Then they tore it down basically in the early 2000s, and then they were able to build it back up again by trading Colon, their other homegrown ace, again, who kind of developed a little bit too late to join Bell and Lofton at their peak. But they really built the second iteration, the 05 almost won the division, 06 team that was scuttled by a horrible bullpen, 07 team that, you know, had a 3-1 lead in the AL Championship Series. That was really built mostly through trades, and then they did, again, have a homegrown ace, this time with CeCe Sabathia.
I'll say trades, and they also – there were some – I'd say trades were a key part, but also you have to work in the Victor Martinez's and all of the world too, so –
absolutely. International side. I guess what I'm trying to say is that consistently over the course of that, except for guys like Albert Bell, most of the guys for the Indians that I'm thinking of, if I'm missing a detail here or there, I apologize, but most of them were international or trades, not so much through the draft. But they had a top 10, JJ. What was it, 2003 you looked
right.
at?
2000.
That was pretty outrageous.
Well, they had, at that time, you're talking Grady Sizemore, Cliff Lee, Brandon Phillips, who obviously did not really produce it for them. They kind of lost him and watched him produce when he went somewhere else. Jeremy Guthrie, same story as Brandon Phillips. Victor Martinez, Travis Hafner, Josh Barr, Johnny Peralta, Coco Crisp, Ryan Church, Ben Broussard, Willie Taveras, Ben Francisco, Jody Garrett. They were producing. The funny thing about it is that Indians group, if you say building from within and kind of letting a group of prospects turn into a group of very successful big leaguers, they did what you want to do. They had a couple. I mean, CC Sabathia, Cliff Lee have become aces. Sizemore, Hafner, Victor Martinez, even Johnny Peralta, I think you can say at one point were legitimately impact players.
Yeah, Johnny Peralta was a 20 home run a year shortstop. Right. Those are almost vanished right now.
Those were all impact players. Well, that's what you're looking to develop. You want to develop impact players. In their case, they largely did, but it didn't work out as well as I think they would have hoped, and definitely probably not as well as Indians fans would have hoped, because you had a year where the bullpen sunk everything. You had a year where they won 93 games, and that wasn't enough. And really, I think one of the big things that jumped out is again, about how the window can be pretty small. Sabathia and Cliff Lee are two of the best pitchers in baseball now.
Yeah, no doubt.
The problem for the Indians, though, is that by the point at which Sabathia and Lee became elite aces was right around the time that they got really expensive and were available for, you know, were getting ready to hit free agency. Or
I will say to me, I think that a lot of the formulas that teams and even, you know, analysts, you know, outside analysts like us use, one of the tried and true things is, you can't tie up all your, salary in one or two guys, right? Your payroll. If the two guys are two of the five best pitchers in baseball, what do you think, JJ? Do you think the Indians wish that they had? You think if the Indians had it to do over again, that they would try all they could to lock up Sabathia and Lee both and keep them both? I mean, I know there's a lot of money. That's $300 million in terms of long-term commitments, but If you're starting with two number ones, I don't know. Do you go Miami Heat on it? Can the rest of the team be basically, if you're doing it right far, in terms of development, just young prospects and young players and the occasional 6-year free agent fine? Do you think they could have stayed competitive if they had re-signed Sabathia and Lee, or is that not even plausible?
Well, I do think if you had it all to do over again, you definitely want to spend some of that money that way instead of Travis Hafner and his long-term extension. But
yeah, that to me, it looks like Hafner is the number one. It's not his fault. He got hurt and he hasn't been able to stay healthy. But that contract is the number one thing that killed that club.
But the bigger thing is I think you just hit on it, and this is another one of the steps that we talk about in this prospects dependence feature, is you can't bring a group of guys up, and they, even if they turn into stars, and then say you can't then have a fallow farm system over the next 3 or 4 years.
You're right. That's the lesson that you wrote that I had not really considered before. But after that first wave,
you have to have a
you
second.
You got to have wave two, and that's it. You got to have wave number
one,
two.
One of the other things you talked about in this feature, you look at the Diamondbacks. Again, the Diamondbacks brought up a group that it's not like you look and say, okay, we had the Diamondbacks, I think it was 2007, as our number one farm system. And here's their top 10. Justin Upton, Chris Young, Carlos Gonzalez, Alberto Callaspa, Miguel Montero, Micah Owings, Mark Reynolds, Dustin Nipper, Tony Pena, and Ross Ohlendorf. Oh, yeah, by the way, Brett Anderson, number 11.
Right.
That's not a group, but that's not a group where you say, wow, those guys have just all failed to be anything like what they hoped they would be. You know, the pitching has not turned out, except for Anderson, you could say.
Right. Owings and Nippert have been bit players. The version I'm looking at has Anderson number 10. I guess by the time the magazine came out, or the web tank came out, there'd been a deal.
Right.
I mean that's Brett Anderson's the best pitcher out of that, and he had just been drafted in the second round, a high school second round pick, and you know, I always love reading about those things. I mean, Brett Anderson listens to some of the podcasts and reads some of our stuff, and he used to find great humor in the biggest knock against Anderson is his soft body and lack of athleticism and agility. He had trouble fielding bunts and covering first base at times in high school. He gets a real kick out of that, suffice it to say.
But you look at that and you say, okay, well, that group is a pretty solid group. And you do have to remember, they made the playoffs that year. You know,
even with a negative.
Yeah, I was going to say, not because in large part of those. The funny thing, Micah Owings was probably the one in that top 10 who contributed most to them making the playoffs that year. But that's become the core of that team. But really the problem is that group came up, and by 2008, that farm system was bereft of talent.
And the other part of that is that their success coming ahead of time, coming ahead of schedule, almost threw them off. Well, it did throw them off, it seems like. Like the Indians had their success in 05. That almost seemed to throw them off a little bit. You know, they still made that pennant run in 07, despite the fact that, you know, that was Cliff Lee's, you know,
going to the minors year, yeah.
Right, exactly. Wasn't even on the playoff roster, which is really kind of mind-boggling when you think back on it. Just how everything really was working. A lot of things were working against the Indians, and they still came within a game of the World Series. But with the Diamondbacks, they almost got too many breaks, it seems like, early, JJ. And then once they had that success, the temptation, like you said, they didn't have that second wave, and the temptation of, oh, we've arrived. Well, they really hadn't arrived yet, had they?
Well, and you look at that team, and that team, you know, if you look at runs scored, runs allowed, they were negative on runs allowed, you know, on their run differential that year, which is not usually the sign of a playoff team. It's a sign, in their case, it was a sign of a team with a lot of good luck and a really good bullpen, which means they were exceptional in one-run games. Well,
right.
So then they made their moves. They traded away Carlos Gonzalez. They traded away Brett Anderson to get Dan Herron. And it's not like Dan Herron didn't end up being very good for them. But again, it's that problem. It's everything has to come together for you. For them, really what happens, when Brandon Webb got hurt, they were done. Because you can't replace, or at least they could not in any way replace an ace like that. And it's just, again, the things that jump out from this is how hard it is to do this. Not that you can't have a year.
Right.
Now, it depends on what your definition of success is. Because it's funny, like we tied this to the Royals. The Royals are our number one farm system, and I think that's by a pretty good margin. And they have a very deep farm system with a lot of potential impact players. And the question really is okay, this is a Royals team that has not really had any success. You could be, you know, I think the way I put it was, or had at least at one point, you could be legally drinking a beer as you listen to this podcast as a Royals fan and not remember success at all. A little while back, I said, okay, Royals fans, I'm just asking you, what would qualify as success to you as far as what has to happen with this group of prospects? And the answers were not two World Series titles, you know, three appearances in the World Series. A couple of people were like, I want to make it to the World Series. Can we win the World Series once? And so with that, it is something where if you look at it,
the bar for success is not set that high by their fans.
By that standard of success, well, the track record's pretty good for them. Because the Indians, you can say they weren't as successful as they wanted to be because they never won it. They never reached that ultimate pinnacle. But at the same time, that farm system that the Indians produced, you know, that had going in 2003 meant that they were a contender for 3 out of 4 years.
Right. They were thought to be in it.
They were thought to be in it. They made the playoffs in a stretch during that. And as you said, I mean, they weren't that far away. You could argue that the Diamondbacks, you know, by that 2007 team that was playing the playoffs had Chris Young, Justin Upton, Micah Owings, all those guys. In some ways, you could argue that that was a success. You can, but, you know, I want to bring in the two teams who I think are the, if you're a Royals fan, the two teams that you hope to emulate the most are the Twins and the Rays.
And the Twins, correct me if I'm wrong, were the Twins ever the number one organization in our talent rankings? They've always been relatively high.
No.
But they've really never been number one.
They have not. They have not during the prospect handbook era. The knack with them is being relatively high, and the interesting thing with them is that they are exactly the proof of the it's not one wave, it's wave after wave.
Right.
The Twins have contended while completely turning over their team.
Yeah, there's never really been a significant pause. And really, in the 5 years, I guess, that I've been doing their farm system rankings for us, you know, Nick Blackburn is their worst number one prospect. That year where Blackburn was the number one was their worst farm system year. And that year they also traded Santana, and that trade didn't really work out. And they still made the playoffs the next year. Or they tied for first and missed the playoffs on game 163, and they've made the playoffs the subsequent 2 years. I mean, they have had – so they really are – the reason that people hold them up as the model is not because they I don't think it's because other executives say, you know, we want to always trade power arms for guys who throw strikes and just have a bunch of 3 and 4 starters who throw strikes too. You know, that's not really the part people are trying to emulate with the Twins, although maybe they should. The part they are trying to emulate is you don't ever stop scouting. You don't ever stand still scouting and player development. You don't have a year or two – you just can't have a year or two like the Diamondbacks had where, okay, our big league team is good. Let's draft a bunch of low-ceiling college guys and hope that we get some role players. And that's basically what the Diamondbacks did. I mean, that's with the exception of Jared Parker, that little stretch after like a 2007, 2008, 2009 drafts was a pretty – I guess it's 06 to 08 really, with the exception of us, Upton, and Parker – I guess Upton was 05, but it's a pretty fallow period there in their drafts for 3 straight years. The Twins just have not had that. They keep on churning it out, and that's even with a lot of low periods for them internationally, because they've – Latin America, they had a very long fallow period, the Twins did, where they did not develop their own homegrown Latin players. You know, Liriano, Santana, their best guys, have all come from outside the organization. So
they've really been
the model franchise.
That right there, by the way. If you want to talk about things that are tough to emulate, it's okay, we're going to go out and get a number one, number two starter, and we'll do it through the Rule 5 draft, and we'll do it for trading when a guy's in A-ball.
Again, I don't think you can underestimate these heist trades. When you make these heist trades, I mean, Jeff Bagwell was the rock of the Astros for 15 years. I mean, I know he had Biggio there too, but I mean, this is a Hall of – I mean, that trade, it's that one trade changed the course of a franchise. And the Twins, you know, where would the Twins be without that Pierzynski trade? Would they have had this level of success? I don't know if they would have. I mean, Joe Nathan was pretty doggone good there and could be again. And obviously the Santana, you know, Rule 5 pick, that's just great scouting, and it, you know, there's a little bit of luck there. You know, you gotta get lucky. You know, he stayed healthy and all those kind of things. But the Twins are one of the models, but the Expos kind of are the other model too.
I was gonna say, I'll bring up the Rays, because the Rays are also another team that does it wave after wave. The Rays,
right?
The Rays kind of just said farewell to the first group of the core of the successful Rays teams. Crawford's gone.
Right.
They traded away Garza. That being said, I don't know about you, but personally, I expect to see the Rays contending for several years to come.
Yeah, and not just that. You saw their high class A team last year down in Charlotte for that weekend, and the pitching that they had on that team, you did the Florida State League prospect list, was pretty outrageous. Durham contends every year in the International League and usually has prospects, and our Matt Eddy is down in spring training, and he was at a B game the other day. I've seen him tweet about this, and he was just tweeting out what Durham's roster was going to be. Was in that game that he watched. It was an inter-squad game. Matt Moore was pitching for the Montgomery team, and he shut down a good AAA lineup with some decent prospects like Desmond Jennings, Robinson Chirinos on that roster that they acquired from the Cubs. They've got Chris Archer from the Cubs, Brandon Guyer from that Cubs deal. You know, their prospects are a little bit heavier loaded on the pitching side right now for their organization, but they're still quite a bit of talent, obviously, in the Tampa organization, or else we wouldn't have ranked them as the number two farm system. So they're definitely in reload mode, and you know, not afraid to take some risks in the draft either. Also, I think a kind of a underrated international operation with Tampa. They seem like they've got a decent stream of really some young power arms out of Latin America. I'm forgetting the left-hander's name who sounds really good in their farm system. I just was ranking our prospects by position last night. That's going to be the next issue. Any Romero, that guy's scouting report sounds really impressive. Obviously, we like Alex Colome. They've got a burgeoning Latin program there as well to complement what they do in the draft.
And as we have to mention also, I think it's required to mention with all these, is that, and they have pretty much an extra, like, what is it, 78 picks in the first two rounds or something like that.
Yeah, it's going to be really fascinating to watch. This is obviously a good draft, perceived as a strong draft class, perceived as a deep draft class, both on the college and the high school sides. More deep on the high school side than it is strong at the top, whereas the college side is really loaded at the top. So this is going to be a pretty fascinating draft exercise to see how much Tampa spends and what they decide to do, how they decide to approach this draft.
Right, but the point we're trying to make here is that – and the other thing I do think we have to point out with the Rays is the Rays also have traded very well. Because the Rays, if you look at these successful Rays teams, part of it has also been built through trades, you know, and or, you know, kind of picking. Jason Bartlett was, you know, a key member of those teams as a shortstop. Well, that was, I don't want to say it was a throw-in in the Delman Young Matt Garza trade, but he wasn't he wasn't the main piece, at least, or I don't think the Twins viewed him as the man piece that they were giving away.
No, no doubt they did not. And I think, like you said, all these teams have what the Rays have done so well to me is they've had the complementary pieces that, you know, in Arizona, one of their big complementary pieces in 07 was Eric Burns. And they overvalued Eric Burns, locked him up, which prompted them to trade Carlos Quentin.
And Carlos Gonzalez.
Like 10 cents on the dollar.
Yeah, I mean,
and exactly made them say, okay, yes, we can include Carlos Gonzalez in this Dan Heron trade. And then Eric Burns flopped. You know, in Tampa, they had Carlos Pena. He had his big year, but instead of locking him up, Tampa kind of wrote him out. His performance was not as good his last couple of years as it was when he first got to Tampa. And they lost
him. They wished
him
luck,
you know,
and they said, good luck with your future endeavors.
That's it. You're not a $10 million a year player. We could at least do as well. And, you know, like you said, I mean, like, they've had to do that. And then they made some smaller trades. I mean, their Kazmir trade, I think, is one of the bigger success stories for them. They, again, a young player, face of the franchise for a while. You could see there would have been some sentiment and some reason to lock that guy up. But they sold high on him. They've got Alex Torres. They got Sean Rodriguez out of that already, helping their big league roster. That's a trade that's going to be paying them dividends for a while, I think.
And that's the old Branch Rickey adage, you know, better to trade a year too soon than, you know, to get rid of a player a year too soon than a year too late. And
right. And
that's one of the things I think that is also you have to watch with this. And this will be what's going to be fascinating to watch with the Royals over the next couple of years. They're going to bring up – it looks like we're going to see the first couple of guys are showing up. I if you'd have told me that Aaron Crow – would be one of the first guys to hit the big leagues, I would have been a little surprised, I have to admit it. But
right. But
the first couple of guys are starting to trickle in. But by the end of this year, and by especially the start of next year, you're going to really see a large majority of these prospects hit the big leagues. Well, what, you know, talking to executives from other teams who've done this before, one of the key things going forward is, okay, you have to know who your core players are, who are the guys you're going to build around. And I think the Royals have a pretty good sense of who those guys are right now. Hosmer.
Yeah, Moustakas, Hosmer, and Myers, and then Montgomery and Lamb,
right.
and we'll see who else. But I mean,
that's
a pretty good core five.
That's your core.
Yeah.
That's the, okay, if these guys all fail, then we're done.
We're in trouble. Yeah, exactly.
The other
somebody, Dayton Moore, becomes a special assistant
right.
to some general manager.
But at the same somewhere. Time, okay, so you have your core. The other thing with this that multiple people pointed out is, but you also have to be aware of, you have to continually evaluate because you may discover that someone else is part of your core that you did not expect. Or you may find that a guy that you believe is part of your core is not going to be part of your core. You know, you again.
I believe in March Madness, I think this is called the Derek Williams core.
Exactly.
Area.
Yeah, that would be a...
the guy at Arizona who Vern Lundquist kept reminding us was not the top recruit in that class and became obviously the best player. But yeah, I mean, is there a candidate for that, JJ? Who is your pick to click? If you had to pick somebody in that Royals deep farm system who becomes a member of that core, who right now maybe the Royals aren't necessarily counting on, who would that be?
I mean, there's a number of guys I could go with on that, but I mean,
My pick is Salvador Perez. I think Salvador Perez is the most likely guy there. He seems like he's got a chance to be a solid everyday regular catcher and maybe a little bit more than that, and that would be a pretty big benefit.
That would, especially you look there, that catching situation they have right now is.
Yeah, it's not good.
There are moves that I don't necessarily myself understand, but Matt Treanor, like if getting him is solidifying your catching situation, that's probably not a good thing. So short term,
a sad commentary on Lucas May.
Yeah, and yeah, that and a very quick like, okay, well we're moving on from Lucas May, it would appear, but Salvador Perez is a very good candidate there. Like I did talk to a couple of people at the Royals who made the joke like. They saw in the first couple of weeks in spring training, it's like, okay, we got to get him down now because this is the guy who spent last year in A-ball, and so he's not ready to be in the big leagues. But the thing about it is that pitchers so enjoy pitching to him, especially, again, we talk about the lack of catching talent that the Royals have at the upper levels right now, that if the longer he stuck around, probably the more and more that the big league club would like him. So, you know, it's time to get him down catching some minor league games so we can have him another year and a half to kind of mature and percolate. But Salvador Perez, I'll go on another, you know, Jason Adam could be a guy who moves pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Draft pick for them last year, high school guy from their area who just has electric stuff. And he could be, when we talk about that next wave, you have the, you know, by the middle of next year, you would expect, say, okay, you've got a rotation that includes Montgomery, Lamb, Duffy, and, say, Dwyer. Say all four of those guys are up, because at some point the Royals are going to hand it over to the young guys, and I'd say maybe they have one veteran to go with that. Well,
right.
A normal rule is that you're not – if you bring up four guys like that and do – I will point out you also then – that's not counting the Crow becoming a starter or Melville turning it around. Or there's other guys that they could possibly fit in there. But those guys aren't all generally going to succeed. Well, you have to figure out, okay, is this guy need more time or is it time to move on? That's always a tough decision. But whenever they reach that point, that may be about the point where, you know, Odorizzi or Jason Adam or Robinson Yambadi or Yordano Ventura or some of those guys are ready to be the next wave. And that's going to be
– That's the part I like the best about the Royals is that while they've spent a lot in the draft, they've all at the and for guys who should move fairly quickly, they've also gotten their Latin American program they've really heavily invested in. And I love Yordano Ventura, Cheslor Cuthbert, and Robinson Yambati. One of the things that stinks the most about Aaron Fitt having moved to California is the lack of random pronunciations of Cheslor Cuthbert in the Baseball America world headquarters. There are lots of things that stink about Aaron not being in our office anymore. One of them is not the ridiculous level of college coverage from California, but not having him say Cheslor Cuthbert, I think he just was so – a lot of us sometimes last year – when you just would keep on talking about Royals prospects, I think we almost got a little overwhelmed. Was like, that guy's a Royal too, you know? And doing the prospect ranking by position. Well, Ben Ballard talked about it for us, JJ, about when he was reminding me in our prospect position rankings to make sure that just because someone ranks, you know, 13th or 15th or 17th in the Royals system, don't leave them out of those prospect position rankings. They're going to be better than a lot of organizations, number fives, number sevens, or, you know, in some organizations, number two or three prospects. So I think we just all got a little overwhelmed sometimes with the depth of talent that Kansas City has. And
JJ, that brings us to the Expos and their place kind of as a history of a franchise with a lot of prospects, both the cautionary tales and the things that they did right. Before we get into Montreal, let's remind everyone that the podcast is brought to you by the Baseball America Digital Edition, which is now available. And the Digital Edition brings you the magazine on the go. No longer are you waiting by the mailbox for the latest issue to arrive, although for me there's some charm in that. Every 2 weeks, you're notified by email that a new digital edition is available for download. You just go to the hyperlink, you know, you just visit the link, baseballamerica.com/subscribe. You can get the digital edition for as low as $176 per issue. And JJ, correct me if I'm wrong, but the issue, the minor league preview with this Blue Wave Prospects to Pennants article, that digital edition is sponsored by Rawlings and is available for free even to non-subscribers, correct?
That is correct. You can just go right now, just click on it and read the magazine as if you have the magazine in front of you, the digital edition.
And with that, the best part of that is that you can read about a lot of this that we're talking about in the podcast. But, you know, JJ, you didn't have room for all the lessons that the expos taught us. Besides the fact that they taught us that baseball probably cannot work long term in a French speaking city, although I actually kind of think it could. What other lessons can the Royals, who obviously don't have a lot of French speakers around, glean from what happened in Montreal?
No. that's my very bad French accent.
I liked it.
But the thing that jumps out is that the expos, when you talk to people who were involved with the expos, even now, 20 years after they were involved with the expos, they can't help but talk about it in this almost romanticized viewpoint of just how great it was to be the group that was building these expos. And the people who are involved with that team, by the way, it's kind of a who's who. I mean, it was an impressive list of people who've gone on. But I could talk about the front office, but I'll just throw this out. Here's your 1990 Montreal Expos minor league managers, okay? Tim Johnson, Jerry Manuel, Don Werner, and Mike Quadi.
That's three guys who wanted to be big league managers.
Big league managers. Yeah.
And that Don Werner, I believe, is Pop Werner. Is that the same guy? Pop Werner?
I don't think that's Pop. Because this is Werner, W-E-R-N-E-R.
So, oh, okay, not the same guy who's the AA Cardinals manager, okay.
But, so before the 1990 season, our top 100, Delino DeShields was number 12, Marquise Grissom was number 17, Mel Rojas was 35, Larry Walker was 42, Will Cordero was 62. They also had Howard Farmer, 69, Reed Cornelius, 100. And they also, right around that time, traded to pick up a young Moises Alou.
Moises Alou.
And not long after that, they traded, a couple years later, they traded Shields for Pedro Martinez. That's the cornerstone of a franchise right there. I mean, that's
a way to end the, you know, to interrupt, you know, the Braves dynasty. Obviously, as you pointed out to me when you were writing this article, you know, they weren't bumping up the Braves until 1994, but still the National League East pre 94 was no picnic. You had the Bonds, Van Slyke, Drabeck Pirates in 1991-92 in one of the better teams, you know, of the last, you know, 30 years, three straight division titles. And then you had the 1993 Phillies, certainly a charmed team, and kind of a team of destiny kind of thing. And then, of course, you know, the Braves had already won three straight divisions in the National League West and, you know, won 104 games in 93, come into the Expos division in 94, and the Expos just brushed them aside, which was, you know, they had 74-40 at the time of the strike. So I guess one of the lessons that you learn from the Expos is take advantage of your window of opportunity when it's there. Their window of opportunity was shut on them quite rudely by the 94 strike. The Royals have the benefit right now of what seems to be a very seamless, painless CBA renegotiation, JJ. But what other lessons, I guess, other than don't have your peak year in the middle of Armageddon, do they pass on?
Yeah. Please schedule your peak at a year that's not going to have the World Series canceled. Step one. Sorry, you know, there's just nothing that could have been done about that.
Is it ownership kind of another part of this?
Yeah,
too?
Ownership's a part of it. But the other thing that is kind of the reminder, it does fit also into that whole message of the window is short. What happened with the Expos, and by the way, do remember, they had just traded away. We talked about that list I just gave to Shields, Grissom, Rojas, Walker, and all that. They just traded away Randy Johnson at that point, too.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. 1990, 91, yeah.
You know, so we're talking something pretty insane. But the message, though, is the window is short. Yeah, I think that's the message you can take from it. ownership does matter, because in their case, what happened is that the owner who they'd had sold the team. And if they'd have continued to have Charles Bronfman, I think I'm pronouncing that somewhat close to right.
I think you did.
Still the owner, they maybe could have, he was rich enough that they maybe could have continued to, held on to some of those players. But I think also the other message is in some ways kind of an encouraging thing, though, of what you hope for if you're a Royals fan. You look at that 1990 top 100 list we just gave you, the Shields, Grissom, Rojas, Walker, Will Cordero. None of those, their top five guys there, none of them failed.
Right. No, you're right.
You know, Rojas was a solid reliever, which isn't as valuable as having a number one starter, but he was at his best an exceptional.
He was outrageous. Yeah, he was outrageous at his peak. He was a difference maker, reliever for 80 to 100 innings a year at his peak.
And really, what it comes down to is that the other thing that just seems to kind of, that seems to be true of all these teams we're talking about, though, and this is the thing we'll have to see with the Royals. The other thing that most of these teams did is wise trades. We talked about the Twins. I mean, the Twins, without a doubt, made some great trades. We talked about some of them. The Rays made some great trades. The Expos, again, we talked about Moises Alou. Moises Alou was a great pickup.
And to line it as Shields for Pedro Martinez, I mean, absolutely, that's as good as it gets.
We're not talking about John Wetland yet. John Wetland also.
Right, for not much for the Dodgers.
Yeah, so that's another thing that jumps in here. We'll have to see how well the Royals do at that part. But it's, I guess we'll kind of, to wrap up, I'll throw the question to you. So what do you think is going to happen with the Royals with this? What do you think?
Well, yeah, that's the way that I wrap it up is, you know, the things that the Royals can't control to this point that they could, you know, you have the draft picks and you can go sign players you want to internationally. That's kind of a free market. At those things, they've done pretty well. I was really going to ask you, those last pieces are Dayton Moore. I think we've established they have a second wave. The real key is, do you trust Dayton Moore that he will be the general manager who will find the right pieces to surround those prospects, A? And B, will David Glass and Royals ownership keep the right players and continue to fund the acquisition of players through the draft internationally to keep those successive waves coming? I think I trust the talent. I trust their prospects. I think their prospect class is pretty mighty. And I'm stunned by the depth of the talent. I had a question in the chat. They were recording this. I chatted at BA.com. And I'd take Salvador Perez, their 17th prospect, over Mark Rogers, the Brewers' first prospect. But the Brewers have produced a lot more in the big leagues the last 5 years. The second part of that really would be, I'd rather be the Brewers. I think the Brewers have a chance to win a World Series, you know, right now, this year. I'm not saying they're the favorite, but I think they have a chance to win the World Series. So I'd rather be Milwaukee. You can rebuild a farm system. I have some faith in Dayton Moore to make the right moves at the big league level. I don't have any faith in David Glass. So I think the Royals will, but I don't think David Glass can screw this up. I think they have enough talent to overcome that obstacle, JJ. That's my take on it. I think they're going to be have a run that's a little bit better than what they had in Cleveland in 2005 and 2007. And it wouldn't shock me if the Royals became the new Twins as far as for a 5 to 7 year window where they were the medium market team that could. What do you think? I don't think they're going to be as consistent as the Twins for, and the Twins have been good for a decade now. I don't know if the
Twins is a pretty high bar. Yeah, it's,
yeah, I definitely don't see them becoming the Braves. I don't see Dayton Moore as quite being as skilled as his mentor John Schuerholz. I don't know that there's a Bobby Cox around. So
I mean, look,
that's also a very, very high bar.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's that's an exceptionally high bar to say, okay, well, you're going to make the playoffs.
A lot of that credit has to go to luck, obviously, too, for the Braves. But they also traded pretty well. They never seemed to give up anybody that came back to haunt them. And, they picked up Fred McGriff for a bag of magic beans and, a couple other trades like that worked well for them. But I have more faith in the prospects than I have in the ownership. But I think you have to trust a front office that evaluates talent the way they've been able to. And I know that last year I had zero faith in them, and I've been proven wrong as far as their ability to evaluate, because it's pretty amazing stable of talent they put together.
Well, I actually, one of the things you brought up, when you asked about the ownership, I posed that question to Dayton Moore myself for this story, and kind of, asked the question, well, in some way, I can't remember exactly how it was formed, but Dayton made the point. He said, look, since I've been here, the three best players that we've had are Zach Greinke, Joaquin Soria, and Billy Butler. And I think I think he's accurate there, that those are the three best players they've had. And he made the point, none of those three were 6 years and gone. Every one of those was extended. Now, Greinke's obviously gone now because he told them he wanted to leave. But
right.
But there is some point, you could at least, there is some point, some argument can be made that it's not an automatic thing that all these guys are going to leave after 6 years. Now, some of them are, because you can't, if this team develops as expected, you can't keep everybody. And it's funny how you mentioned that. I think, there is kind of a question. I think there's a very much a skepticism among Royals fans about whether a Dayton Moore team can succeed long term. And I think there is a lot of skepticism there. And it becomes kind of we've been talking about paradoxes the last couple of podcasts, but this is an interesting paradox, is that, and kind of pose the question in the story that goes with this, is can a front office that builds a farm system like this really be, kind of not know what they're doing? And it's hard to say that a group could evaluate so well at the minor league level and just not be able to do it at the major league level. It's right. It's hard to see how that can happen. But at the same time, you have to, work in there that, hey, there haven't been a whole lot of moves at the major league level where you can point to and say, wow, the Royals really did that well in 2008 or 2009. Yeah,
all their big league free agent moves have been disasters. I mean, there's another way to put it, is there? The one that the worst one was the one that seemed like it got, the best one was the one that got the most negative press.
Right. And I was going to say, Gilmesh move, the contract that they signed him to ended up being okay.
Right. I win that on the bet board. I seem to recall defending that deal at the time.
But that one.
But even though that deal was not a good deal.
But you can defend that one. That one defends along the lines of, if Jason Wirth ends up being one of the better, right fielders in the game for the next several years, and the Nationals overpay for him, but you say, well, they had to overpay and they got what they hoped to get out of him. In Gilmesh's case, he was their best pitcher until his shoulder fell off. Not second best pitcher. I should say second best starting pitcher, I should make clear.
Right.
He was their best.
Right.
But he was their
second. But Jose Guillen, Willie Bloomquist, really their best other acquisitions have been getting guys signing guys to a 1 year deal and then trading them, which Dayton seemed to indicate to you that's their plan this year again, too, was it not, this offseason?
Yeah, but now here's one point I will make in defense of the front office. We've talked about, when you said the Brewers have produced much more in the last several years, everyone has produced much more in the last 4 years than the
That's
Royals
right.
have. The Royals,
That's right.
In fact, Jim, just in a story that ran the same issue, again, available for free in digital edition, sponsored by Rawlings, if you want to check it out, the Royals rank dead last of what teams have produced in the last 3 years. Well, so with that, if you want to give a defense, one of the defenses is you have to sign players to – there's there hasn't, the only player that they've had at the AAA level who you can in any way argue has been held back because of trades or signings they've had for veterans is Keila Kahui.
Right.
Because they literally, there have been multiple years where they have not had another player at AAA who you could point to and say, that guy should be in the big leagues. And
Keila is actually the one guy who gives me some real pause because he has on-base skills. And you know, I'm not Captain Moneyball here, but he has on-base skills. I'm not. But he has on-base skills, and they have brought in a lot of players who don't have on-base skills. That's been a pretty consistent thing about the players they've signed, from Jose Guillen to Rick Ankiel to Jeff Francoeur to whoever. Well,
the example, the guy who they blocked, Keila Kahui, Mike Jacobs.
Exactly. So Keila has on-base skills, and they don't seem to recognize that maybe that in and of itself merits a look, especially a low-cost look.
So, I mean, we will see over the next couple of years. The thing I'll say is that, again, I expect to see a 90-plus win season out of the Royals in 2013, 14, or 15, and probably expect to see at least two of them in a four-year span there. You know, I figure by the end of 2012, we're talking about this is the team that we're talking is majority of these prospects have made it up. And by 2013 or probably even more 2014, we really see them doing something. Now,
well, JJ, I'll tell you the team that's going to do something right now. I'm interrupting you because I just got in my inbox the Omaha Royals roster, which is kind of exciting.
I'm checking my inbox right now because I want to see this too.
Danny Duffy, Lewis Coleman, Vin Mazzaro, Mike Montgomery, Everett Tieford, Manny Pena up as their catcher. Kind of like that. Former longtime Royals prospect who's now just a space filler, Irving Falu. But Eric Hosmer at AAA, along with Mike Moustakas, Johnny Giovitella, Clint Robinson, and Lance Zawadzki, with an outfield of Gregor Donde Esta Blanco, Lorenzo Cain, and David Lowe.
Which, by the way, that's a outfield of – that's going to cover some ground out there.
So that's a good AAA team. I don't think there's a minor league free agent among the group. Orlando, Kane, Blanco, Lowe in the outfield, Zawadzki, Robinson, Moustakas, Hosmer, Giovitella. Is, I guess, maybe Cody Clark? Is he a minor league free agent?
I think he might be. And Zawadzki was a waiver pickup, right, if I remember right?
I believe so, yeah. I believe
so. He wasn't a minor league free agent, but
I can't remember if there was a minor trade there or what.
Yeah, it was one of those minor deals of some sort.
But this team is incredibly low on free agents. Kevin Pousatis, by the way, personal cheese ball of yours.
Who's at least as of yesterday was still on their 40-man. So
I believe he still is on the 40-man. But that, ladies and gentlemen, is a prospect roster. I mean, that's
a triple-A team.
That's a triple-A team with Hosmer and Moustakas. I mean, there almost is a prospect at every position there. That's pretty sick. I mean, that's sick.
And then your double-A team is the Will Myers, John Lamb, Chris Dwyer group.
Probably Chris Colon, too. Probably Christian Colon.
Yeah. Jeff Bianchi's the second baseman coming back from injury. And then I think Derek Robinson's going to be their center fielder again.
Probably Salvador Perez behind the dish.
Behind the plate. And then you're talking about it. High A, you'll be looking at – I checked tonight. I had not seen the High A roster being released yet. But you're talking about Melville and probably Odorizzi. And I think Noel Aguayas might be there even at the start of the season. And
wow.
Maybe you could possibly work Eibner in there also. And at every level, it's going to be a fun team. They're going to have a fun team to watch.
I believe the word to describe it is epic. Sorry to drop a Rome in there, but JJ, I interrupted you in the middle of a point, then we can wrap up with that. But you were...
the point is I do expect to see. I will be surprised not to see this group succeed. Now, that, you know, I plan to have a follow up story kind of for whenever I'm off of jury duty, plus a little while, to finish it up, putting it together. But to get a little sabermetric for a second here, I did this study I'm working on about, you know, okay, let's take the top 30s. Let's really and add the depth chart, if we can, of these top organizations. And if you can get to 45 or so wins above replacement, that's when you're talking about, you know, at least a playoff contender, 40 to 45 wins above replacement. Well, you're not going to get that from one group of prospects, or at least I couldn't find a team that did. However, if you can get to close to 30 out of one group of prospects, it shouldn't be too hard, especially if you're talking about guys who are relatively inexpensive, it shouldn't be too hard to find the other 10 to 15. Right. And that's going to be kind of the what will be interesting to see with the Royals, because for one, you can get some of that from guys you already have on your roster. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe 10 of that comes from the maybe 8 of that, say, comes from Billy Butler, Joaquin Soria. You can get that from guys coming up who are not part of that group. Maybe, you know, we're talking about Sonny Gray or down the road, Bubba Starling or whoever they draft 5 overall this year could be part of that. But the other part of that is that, and then this will be the key test for them, is okay, or you need to find some guys to fill in holes, you know, from trades and free agency. And that's where, if you look at the teams who we're talking about being successful, and we're talking about being successful because the point of this story, we haven't talked about the Yankees, we haven't talked about the Red Sox, we haven't talked about teams like that, not because they're not very successful, but what the question that was really being posed here is, can you build it from the farm system when free agency is not really much of an option?
Right.
And, you know, if we did this story a couple of years from now, you might be able to throw the Reds into there as another example of that, because we saw that last year. The Reds made the playoffs, and it was a very homegrown team that did that. But most all of those teams, one of the keys is that they've made trades that really kind of bulk up that lineup or that pitching staff. That's the thing we still have to see with this Royals group. And it's going to be interesting to watch over the next couple of years. Hey, I'll say this. By the end of this year, I'll be watching or listening to a lot more Royals games than I definitely have in the last 5 to 10 years. And that includes, I mean, I've been doing the Royals top 30 for a while, but there hasn't been a whole lot of reason to catch many Royals big league games because of that. That'll start to change.
That's right. I'm just waiting to see who will be your personal Nick Blackburn. Who will be the guy that you have an irrational shine to in the Royals organization? But that has yet to develop yet. You've been very rational about it, which you're to be applauded, because it's a really neat story. And I definitely would encourage people to take advantage of that free digital edition. And if you need a link to it, just find at JJCoop36 on Twitter. Or at John Manuel BA, I retweeted it. So we both have a link to it on our Twitter. So, JJ, again, I encourage people to read the prospects to pennants, and just a job well done by you. And we miss you in the office. So
I hope
get done
to be back
your
soon.
Civic duty soon.
I hope to be back soon.
Well, for JJ Cooper, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next time on the Baseball America podcast. Until then, so long, everybody.